Welcome to the Pastor and Intern Podcast. My name is Eric, the pastor of the podcast, and I'm here with Will, the intern. How you doing, Will?
I'm doing good.
So who do we have on the podcast today?
Yes, we're talking to Dr. Jamie Dew.
Ooh, who's that?
Jamie Dew. He was elected president of New Orleans Baptist Theological Seminary.
So does that mean he's important?
Yeah, I would say so.
Okay, yeah, I agree.
He's pretty important.
Yeah, he was very important.
He was just recently elected on June 5th of this year, 2019. He has two PhDs.
Two. What?
One in theological studies from Southeastern.
Okay.
And then a doctor of philosophy in philosophy from the University of Birmingham, UK. I've never
heard
of
it. We have to ask him about that, right? Like, that's something that we can't not ask about.
Yeah. Birmingham, UK.
Like, that's a place. Like, we're not talking about Alabama.
Seriously,
we're talking about the UK.
Yeah. He's got an MDiv in pastoral ministry from Southeastern.
Of course he does. It's the
Bachelor of Science in Biblical Studies
from
Toccoa Falls College.
Okay, we're going to have to ask him. Are these places real? Like, I hope that he's a chill enough guy that I can ask him if his degrees are real.
Before he went to New Orleans, he was at Southeastern, that we'll talk about as well.
Okay.
He was also a pastor for 8 years.
Really?
8 years.
Where are we asking him about that on here?
Wake Forest, North Carolina. So he went from, it seems like, he went from being a pastor to a professor. Maybe he did both at the same time. Who knows? And then to now being a president. Isn't that crazy how that works?
Yeah, it's pretty crazy.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah.
All right. You ready?
I'm ready to call him.
All right, let's give him a call.
Okay.
Hello.
Hey, Dr. Dew.
Yeah.
Hey, it's Will, and I'm joined here with Eric. Thanks for joining us on the podcast today.
So, Dr. Dew, you recently got elected as the president of the seminary, and when we do these interviews, it's pretty important to us that our listeners know the testimonies of the people that we interview, and so just kind of give us a glimpse into your testimony.
All right. Yeah, sure. So, I grew up in a very blue-collar, middle-class home in Statesville, North Carolina, and my parents split up when I was about 7 years old. And that pretty much just crushed me as a kid, to be honest with you. As a result of all of that and some other things that were kind of going on in life at the time, ended up doing very poorly in school as a kid, failed second grade. They went ahead and let me push through and go to third, but then I failed third grade. And so it was just a bad scenario. And I wasn't reading, wasn't really, you know, terrible, just terrible in school. Wasn't reading until fourth or fifth grade, somewhere in there, and just having a real difficulty there. So, you know, that kind of marred my childhood in many ways, causing me to struggle, very low view of myself and capabilities, and then all the behavioral issues that would come with that. By the time I was in middle school, I was into things that I shouldn't have been doing. By the time I was in high school, I was drinking a lot. I was smoking a lot of pot and doing a lot of those types of things that, you know, a lot of kids do. I just seemed to do it with a lot of flair and a lot of gusto. And so by the time I got in my junior year in high school, I had gotten arrested twice, once for stealing 7 cases of beer out of the back of a grocery store, attempting to steal 8, but we dropped one of those cases of beer, and that's what got us arrested.
Wow.
So, the cops pulled us over, arrested us right there on the spot. And that just kind of begins a process in my life of a deep, humbling process where God used that to ultimately bring me to faith in Christ. I ended up getting arrested again a couple months later, this time for smoking some pot in my Jeep going down the road, got arrested again. And in no time at all, I mean, just bang, bang, junior year, get arrested twice. And so that definitely got my attention. That second arrest was on October 9th, 1994, and I moved that very night to Raleigh, North Carolina with my dad, who 7 years before had left and or moved out and had been begging me for 10 years to come live with him, and I just never had any interest in doing that. And so when I got arrested that second time, I knew I pretty much needed to change something drastic right then, but nothing I knew to do was working. So I moved to Raleigh, North Carolina. God started a process of about 8 months of humbling me, bringing me down until into my junior year in high school, between the junior year and senior year that summer, June 16th, 1995, I ended up at a youth camp a Centrifuge youth camp. And so I tell people, you know, it's through the faithful work of Southern Baptist people and Southern Baptist entities and organizations and ministries that I ended up coming to faith and being discipled. But I got saved at a Centrifuge youth camp, June 16th, 1995. And I knew really that night, not only that I was now a believer, that I was home in Christ, I also knew that I would spend the rest of my life serving Christ. I didn't know what that meant or what that looked like. I didn't really know anything about calls to ministry and such, but I really sort of knew then that that was what I was doing in my life. And I mean, I was a very bad student. I graduated high school with a 1.6 GPA. But God was clearly doing a work in my life and calling me to study and prepare. So end up going to college, do a biblical studies degree at Tocoa Falls College, and come back to Southeastern Seminary in the year 2000 to start my MDiv. I did my MDiv, stayed through PhD. It was during that period I started, as I was sharing my faith with people, that I met people with a lot of questions and skepticism and stuff like that. And so I just started doing apologetics, and that's how I ended up in philosophy and in academics. I didn't really set out to be an academic at all. I just I knew I had questions and to certain questions that I couldn't answer that I wanted to be able to answer better. So that's why I did PhD work and got into all of this. Didn't mean to be an academic. Certainly didn't mean to be an administrator or president, but that's what the Lord did in a nutshell to get me where I'm at today.
Now, was it during your time at Southeastern during your MDiv? Is that when you were the pastor of a church in that local area?
Correct. Well, I, at the beginning of my MDiv, I started off as an interim pastor at a church in Fayetteville, North Carolina. And I did that for a year during my MDiv. I finished that up because it was like an hour and 45 minutes away from the seminary. And I was having to commute back and forth. And I reached a place with them, New Hope Baptist Church in Fayetteville, North Carolina. I reached a spot with them where I felt like they needed more than just a weekend preacher. And I needed to be able to focus on school, because by that point I really felt called to do PhD work. And so I stayed there for a year as an interim pastor. I left. I served on a church staff at a church plant in Cary. And just finished my MDiv. It was actually at the beginning of my PhD there at Southeastern that I started pastoring Stony Hill Baptist Church. I started the PhD program and the pastor there pretty much the exact same time. And I pastored there through my entire PhD. I pastored there for 8.5 years, started teaching it adjunctively at Southeastern as well during that time. And so, yeah, I was there during PhD in the years that followed my PhD.
Did you teach philosophy during that time, or you weren't there yet?
I did. So I taught starting at Southeastern. I started off teaching history of ideas predominantly, which is a core part of the curriculum there in the undergraduate program, where they read through the classical works that have shaped the Western tradition. And I started off teaching those predominantly, and those were seminar type of courses. So they weren't lecture based, where you'd walk in and give an hour long lecture on, you know, say Thucydides or something. You read those books, and then you walk into a room with 10 students or 12 students, and you guide them in discussion through what they've all been reading. And, you know, you read everything from the key philosophers, key theologians, key scientists, key historians, politicians, you know, literary, the writers, you read everything. And so it's no matter what your academic training is, typically it was philosophers, theologians, and English faculty that would teach those predominantly, ethics and stuff like that. But no matter what your academic background was, you had a major learning curve coming into history of ideas to teach that, because it's so diverse. You just have to be ready to read everything. So started off doing history of ideas, and through the process, since my PhD work was in philosophy, started teaching philosophy as well. And then over the years, throughout my whole teaching career there at Southeastern, it just evolved where I was doing less history of ideas, and it became almost exclusively philosophy. And that's really where I actually feel more comfortable anyway, is teaching philosophy, because that's where all my work has been academically.
I'm actually a student right now at Southeastern in the undergrad. Oh,
okay.
And I'm taking History of Ideas 3. And so I can just
completely
agree with what you're saying, is that the reading is super. When I was buying my textbooks this year, I had to buy Plato as well as Aquinas. It's just kind of a weird mixture, you know?
Yeah. Yep, it's really neat.
So I love it when we're talking to someone who works in a seminary that has some sort of pastoral experience. What do you think that pastoral experience did for you as far as in the academia of a seminary?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. My whole life in ministry has been sort of a mix. I've spent as much time in rural churches and the churches of the Southern Baptist Convention as I have in the classroom and the academic side. So I'm an odd duck in that way. Most guys kind of do one or the other, but not both. But I've really done both. And I could answer your question actually the other way around as well. So, you know, the question is, what did being in the church do for me in the classroom? I can talk about what the classroom did for me in the church as well. But for the way you've asked the question, so how did being in the church help me in the classroom? I think in a number of ways. Number one, it really gives you being in the church and how that helps you in the class gives you a lot of practice and reps and just as a communicator. So, you know, think about what you do in a local church, man. If you're not a good communicator, you're just going to have a hard time and struggle. You have to be able to stand in front of people and hold the room. You have to be able to convey your ideas with clarity. You have to be able to be winsome. And so then those skills that you learn in the local church, when you now go into the classroom and deal with very difficult, abstract information and data, you've just had the opportunity through years and years and years of repetition to sharpen your rhetorical skills. And so I think that's a major thing that it did for me. I also think that secondly, it keeps you rooted and grounded in stuff that's very relevant and very important. So, you know, you're sitting there in a local church and you're dealing with, say, senior citizens or moms and dads. Man, they're not interested in the ivory tower stuff. They want to know how this really matters, why this matters and why it applies.
Right.
And so what that does is when you go back in the classroom, you're able to now connect the dots on very difficult intellectual material to basic stuff that everybody wants to know about. The third thing I'd say is I think it just gave me a lot of street cred in the classroom with those who are more pastorally inclined. I mean, consider my discipline. My discipline's philosophy. And there's just a natural default disposition in most people coming into seminary of, I don't think I need this. This is kind of irrelevant for what I'm doing. But if the guy teaching me this has done pastoral ministry and vocational ministry in the church for, say, 15 years, okay, he's got a little street cred. So, the capital that it wins is just enormous. Now, to flip it the other way around, how did the classroom impact me in the pulpit? My gosh, I mean, you are constantly engaging in intellectual rigor and airtight arguments and things like that. And so just from the rhetorical side of that, it just is invaluable to have that kind of training going into the pulpit.
So tell us a little bit more about your time at Southeastern teaching wise. And so what was your title at Southeastern right before you
left? What was my time like? Is that what you said?
Your title.
Oh, my title. Yeah. So, well, gosh, I started off as an outsider looking in when I was in high school, wanting to come to school there. I came as an MDiv student. I was a PhD student. I was an adjunct. I was a regular professor. I was an associate dean. I was a dean. I was a vice president. Other than president, I carried about every title at that school you could have, almost, at least in terms of the levels. And, I got to see Southeastern from every vantage point, and that institution deeply shaped me, and I had an opportunity to shape it back in many ways. My title when I left really had two titles. I was Associate Professor of Philosophy and the History of Ideas. That was my academic faculty title. But then my administrative title was Vice President for Undergraduate Studies and Distance Learning. And so that's the Dean of College part. The colloquial title that was used for me was just the Dean of the College, but the official title was Vice President for Undergrad Studies and Distance Learning. And so I oversaw everything having to do with the college academically. So the faculty, the curriculum, the program of study and such. I also oversaw the prison programs there. I oversaw distance learning for the entire institution, not just for the college. And then I also oversaw the writing center during my time there. And people ask, well, what is that job? What was my job? That's the official titles and such. But my job was to be a catalyst for that college. That's the bottom line. Whether that means pushing for something to happen, protecting something that could happen, encouraging the students, discipling the students, pastoring the faculty, such. My job was to be an advocate and a catalyst for that college in particular, the institution as a whole, but the college in particular. That's really what I did.
So we, a couple months ago, we had the opportunity to talk to Dr. Aiken, and that was such a great conversation. And just in a short few words, what is your impression of Dr. Aiken?
A joy to work for and a good friend to have. Dr. Aiken is not the kind of guy. He wasn't to me. He's not with his team that he's got now. He does not micromanage you. He empowers you to do your job. He expects you to do your job. He's going to let you do it. Occasionally, if he has something specific he wanted you to do, he'd let you know. And when he did, it was so reasonable, you didn't have any problem doing it. But it was really he was an easy guy to work for. He was a fantastic boss to have. Imagine this. Who gets this opportunity, right? I'm 35 years old when he asked me to be the dean of the college. I'm 42 now. I'm 35 when he asked me to be the dean of the college. I'm a kid, for crying out loud. And he hires me to be the dean of the college. And when he hired me, I said, so do you have a job description or anything like that you can give to me? Like, what do I do? And he said, no, I don't really have a job description for you. I said, well, what do I do then? He says, I want you to dream a dream and I want you to build it. Who gets that opportunity?
Yeah, that's true.
Most deans of schools are paper pushers. And if anybody knows me, they know that's not what I am. I can do that if I have to. But I'm a visionary kind of guy. I like to dream. I like to build those things. It was the chance of a lifetime. And here he was giving it to somebody that nobody knew, nobody would have expected. And, he took a risk on me, gave me an enormous opportunity, which at the time, and even now, that in and of itself was an enormous blessing. But of course, providentially, I couldn't have seen it then, but I can see it now. It was not just a wonderful opportunity for me and a wonderful, wonderful ministry to be a part of for 6-7 years. It was also simultaneously a perfect preparation for me in doing what I do. I wasn't the president and I didn't have the burdens of the president, but in many ways I had some of the freedoms of a president. When he said to me, dream a dream, cast vision and build it, that's what presidents get to do, and he let me do that for a piece, a very important piece of that institution for 7 years. And that was just an enormous chance of a lifetime. I'm forever and ever and ever indebted to him. That's just from what happened, indebted to him for what happened while I was there. When this came up that it looked like I was going to be moving to New Orleans to be the president here. At that point, he immediately started just being very intentional with me about grooming me and preparing me and helping me get ready for it. Having conversations with me that he had not had before. Like, now, Jamie, you're about to be president. Here's what you got to understand. Here's what you need to be thinking. Here's where you need to be going with this stuff. And so he's just a fantastic boss to work for and mentor and friend. And I'm deeply grateful for him and Charlotte.
That's incredible. I'm currently looking at your website right here and looking at these books you've written. Can you walk us through some of these? I'm assuming you wrote them all during your time at Southeastern, correct?
I did. Yeah, I did. I went for getting in with publishers is an extremely difficult thing. I was just this young, green, naive kid in my late 20s and my early 30s trying to get published, and nothing I did worked. For 6 years, I knocked on the doors with the publishers and they just kind of pat me on the head and send me on my way like that was cute. And I had people outside of Southeastern, actually, some friends of mine within the evangelical world that were willing to take me under their wing and not only show me the ropes, but use and spend some of their relational capital with these publishers to get me in the door and have a chance. I am who I am today. I have what I have today. I get to do what I get to do today because of older brothers who took a chance on me, like Danny Aiken, or like the first book I ever did, and both of the books on the problem of evil that I've done, I did with Chad Meister, who's not even a Southern Baptist. And these guys were willing to take a shot on me and spend their capital with the publishers to get my foot in the door. And, so it starts off with a book that Chad Meister and I edited on The Problem of Evil, and I wrote one of the chapters for, but we were the co-editors of that book. The second book was a book that Mark Forman and I, Mark's at Liberty University, Mark and I co-authored the How Do We Know book, An Introduction to Epistemology, which Liberty University picked up and used as a required text in their philosophy class online, which sold, by virtue of that, sold like 27,000 copies. Wow. And once that happened, man, it was a lot easier to get in with the publishers at that point.
Yeah.
Stuart Kelly and I did the book on postmodernism. I think it's entitled Understanding Postmodernism is, I think, the name of the book. And Stuart did the bulk of the writing on that. I wrote about 20% of that book. He wrote about 80. I've done it the other way around, where I do the bulk of the writing and the other author does less. But on that book, Stuart wrote the vast majority of that. I was in the middle of some family crises at the moment. My dad almost died. And for about a year, I had to give pretty close attention to him medically. And that was in the middle of all that. Stuart and I did that on postmodernism. More recently, let's see, what else? Oh, Paul Gould and I have just done a book called Philosophy, A Christian Introduction. That probably is the most fun I've ever had on a writing project, doing that book with Paul. And that's with Baker, academic. And man, that was just such a fun book to do. Those are some of the books we've done. I've got a couple other in contract right now that we're working on. I try to always have several in process at various points along the way in process, but that's ultimately kind of been the thought and the strategy. I probably won't have the opportunity to publish as much now that I'm a president. I mean, it's just the reality of it, I think. I could be wrong about that. I'm okay with that. If I don't publish again, that's I'm glad I've gotten to do it. It's been a lot of fun. It's been very fulfilling and rewarding. But I also understand that I have a little bit different job at this point in life, and that's to be now the catalyst for this institution and to lift its banner and march with it and to do everything I can in my power to make this place strong and advance the kingdom and make his people strong that are part of the NOBTS family.
So kind of give us some insight here about the transition to New Orleans. You know, were you looking to be the president? How's the transition been? Give us just some insights on that.
Yeah, so I was not looking to be a president of anything in particular, but especially not a seminary. I had no interest whatsoever in being a seminary president. Because I just, you know, it's clearly such a difficult job. And my thought was always, why would you want to put yourself in that situation? And so I never sought that. And when the New Orleans position came up back in October a year from now, when I heard that Dr. Kelly had announced his retirement, I mean, I was just like everybody else. And then I just started praying for the next president of New Orleans Seminary. And it turns out I was praying for myself. And I didn't want it. I had a friend of mine who's on the faculty here asked me if I would put my name in. And in short, I said no. And I did not feel comfortable putting myself into things and doing that. It's not to say that others can't do that kind of stuff. Put your name in the hat for things and your heart be right. I just knew I couldn't do it. And I knew I wasn't allowed. I wasn't free before God to do those types of things. And I didn't want to. And so anyway, he asked if he could put my name in. And I said, Bob, you know, you can do whatever you want to do, but I'm not doing it. Long story short, he went ahead and pushed my name over to the search committee. They took a look at me because my resume was online. My CV was online on Southeastern's website. They took a look at me and they decided that I was somebody they wanted to talk to. And when they reached out to me, this would have been January 18th of 2019, 9-10 months ago. When they reached out to me, my heart sank. I panicked. I freaked out. I tried to push it back. I didn't want to do it. But I had several friends and mentors that basically told me, like Chuck Lawless, for example, right there at Southeastern, and of course, Danny Aiken and Ryan Hutchinson and some others. Basically, they just said, Jamie, you're being disobedient to God if you refuse to even answer the questions. And I thought, dadgummit. All right. So I'll answer the questions. I'll fill out the questionnaire that they'd sent me. And I just shot straight with the committee. And I figured, man, I'm going to be honest. I'm going to be stone cold honest with what I think about stuff. And if that spooks them, that spooks them. And if it doesn't, then, well, we'll cross that bridge when we get there. And anyway, I kind of thought it would spook them, and it didn't. Turns out they wanted to talk further. They narrowed it to four of us, and they started the interview process with the four of us. And I think the sense I get from them that were on the committee is that pretty quickly they felt like they – pretty quickly they, in God's providence, they narrowed it to me as the one they wanted to focus on for the time. And as it turns out, much to my surprise and such, I too felt a pretty clear sense very early in the process with them in conversation that this might be what God's doing in my life. And so that started, that was about March, middle of March, that they and I sort of got serious like this. From middle of March, once it got really serious, through, I'd say, middle of May, so about another 2 month long process, I grieved and grieved and grieved, leaving Southeastern, leaving my family, leaving a life of normalcy. I mean, I had a really cool, normal life at Southeastern. I mean, I got to coach my boys' baseball teams. I got to, you know, I'd go place people didn't know who I was and didn't care who I was. And that was nice. That was great. And now, you know, you're in a different role in life when you take this responsibility. And that was an adjustment for me. And it still is an adjustment for me in many ways. You know, I just want to be faithful. You know, so anyway, all that to say, the Lord started a process. It became very clear, and I started to grieve. It was interesting, though, as I would grieve the thought of leaving Southeastern and Wake Forest and my normal life that I so loved. Simultaneously, God was giving me ideas, which turned into vision, which turned into passion. And I got to tell you, 9 months later, 10 months later, here I sit. I've been on the job for 4 months. I cannot imagine for the life of me living in Wake Forest and being the dean of the college at Southeastern anymore. As much as I loved it and gave my heart and soul to it, this is where I'm supposed to be. And we've got our work cut out for us, and we've got so, so much to do. But, man, I know I'm where God wants me to be. And I don't use that language lightly. I really don't. I can point to four times in my life where I know that God's called me to be somewhere. And this is the biggest and most obvious to me of any of them.
So we're going to get to New Orleans here in a second, but just out of my own curiosity, I wanted to ask you, what is your relationship like with the other presidents of the seminaries? Like, is there anything there? Have you had any conversations with them?
Well,
because I know you're so close in age with Al Mohler, you know, so I know that y'all have, you know, a lot in common.
It's great. Yeah, great question. So obviously, I have a great relationship with Danny Akin. That's just, I've always had a good relationship with Danny Akin, especially being on his cabinet. He was great to me. He's been even greater to me since I became the president of New Orleans. Just incredible. He has been everything. And honestly, I have to say this for all the rest of them as well. Southern Baptists should be really proud to know that five of their presidents have been everything you would want them to be to me, honestly. Helpful, encouraging, insightful, willing to help. I couldn't ask for anything more from them, and I'm so grateful for all of them. Of course, we're all so busy, we don't have a whole lot of time to sit around and chew the fat and stuff.
Right.
But when I have had the opportunity to be around them, they've just been incredibly gracious and encouraging and helpful to me. It all, of course, started with Danny Akin. I mean, as I mentioned earlier, he immediately started taking extra time to pull me aside, give me insight, and start helping me think. He's been on speed dial for me on a number of occasions already where I'm like, oh, I need some wisdom. And I call him up to get some wisdom. He's been everything you would want him to be. The big X factor for me was, okay, what is an Al Mohler going to be like to me? What is a Jason Allen going to be like to me? What is an Adam Greenway going to be like to me? We're both starting at the same time.
Right.
You hear all these worst case scenarios sometimes about how competitive everybody is. And, you know, sure, there is a sense in which there's a competition there in this, but it has not been nearly as pronounced as I thought it would have been. I'm sitting there right after the announcement comes out that I'm the nominee. I haven't been voted on yet, and I'm sitting there at the lake with my family, and I look down at my phone, and I see Louisville, Kentucky calling me. And I'm like, well, that's probably Al Mohler. I answer the phone, and sure enough, it's Al Mohler. And this is the first time I've ever interacted with Al Mohler. You know, it's Al Mohler, for right, crying out right. loud. I mean, how often does Al Mohler call you on the phone? This man, I mean, I was blown away. I was just genuinely blown away with how kind and encouraging he was to me. He met my children and my wife at the SBC. His wife encouraged the socks off of my wife. He met my children, and then later he wrote them a letter to encourage them. I mean, it's just been, you know, if there's been something he felt like I needed to have a heads up on, he called me. I can't ask for more from these men. People like Jason Allen. I mean, Jason has been... Again, we have not had a chance to spend a whole lot of time together. I'm heading his way, I think, 2 weeks from now to go preach at Midwestern. And we're going to, the families, we have some time set aside for us to all be together and let my kids meet his kids. And Karen has been just extraordinarily kind to my wife. And Jason has been very kind to me, which is a real win because I look at that guy as a genius. I mean, look at what God has done through him at Midwestern. Oh, no, it's really phenomenal. So there's a guy that I certainly feel like I have a lot to learn from. Adam Greenway, here's a guy who's in, if anybody can sympathize with what I'm going through, maybe even more, it's him right, because right. he's taking the helm at he's at the beginning too. Dr. Orge has been kind and, you know, so yeah, I could just keep going. Southern Baptists, just to underscore again, Southern Baptists should be very proud to know that the leaders of their institution have been so kind and so wonderful to a new young rookie. And I esteem them in the highest regard, and I'm grateful to God for them.
So as we conclude our interview here, just give us a little insight into your time at New Orleans right now. And then as a student, I mean, why should I consider New Orleans as a field of study?
Yeah, so New Orleans, I think, has in the minds of many Southern Baptists some obstacles. You know, it's a very post-Katrina narrative that people think of when they think of it down here. I've gotten down here, and here's what I've discovered, and here's what I want everybody to see, and what I will try to show Southern Baptists from here. I'm not going to be in the game of trying to say we're better than this school or that school or anything else like that, because the truth be told, each of us has certain things that are unique to us that maybe we're positioned to do better than some of the others. Every one of us has that. Here's what I think is unique about New Orleans. What I've discovered, here's the people that love this city, love this school, love each other, and have a wicked amount of potential and talent that I think can make an enormous difference for the kingdom. What's unique about New Orleans is that here we are in a city like New Orleans where it's everything. I mean, it's poverty, it's wealth, it's opportunity, it's brokenness, it's Catholicism, it's Southern Baptist, it's Hindu, it's Buddhist. The nations are here. Everything is here. This is an enormously significant place to learn how to do ministry. Think about how important urban is right now for kingdom work. Think about church planning and church revitalization in those contexts. I don't know anywhere better to prepare than right here. I really don't. And here's what's unique about my faculty. My faculty, while maybe not as known as some of the other faculties, I mean, look, some of these other faculties, they've published well. They've done so many good and wonderful things that we're so grateful for. My faculty, maybe not as known, but this is a faculty that's on the front lines of gospel ministry doing really good work. And I am very confident that they can and will do a fantastic job of training up the next generation of servants. So I think that there is some very unique positive things going on at New Orleans here. And I have discovered a people that I absolutely love. And I am delighted to be numbered among them and to be their president and for them to be my people and for them to be my family. And I look forward to seeing how God's going to use us as his servants in the generations to come.
Yeah, that's really good. I am partial. I graduated from Southwestern with my MDiv in May. And so I have, you know, as much as I loved seminary, I'm kind of in this blissful moment where I get to just serve my church. And it's great. But I know that God has called me to further my education as far as doing some doctoral work. And I've considered New Orleans. So can you give me a good pitch right now? You know, why should I come do my doctoral work at New Orleans?
Yeah, again, I'd underscore what I said. When you put the combination of the location where we're at and the faculty that we have within this context of ministry together, I mean, look, if I were starting over, I'm so 19 years in at Southeastern, my blood red bled Navy, and that institution shaped me and I shaped it back. But if I were starting over today, I mean, I would absolutely look right here, because I just can't think of a better location and community of people to learn from. This is a people that are very humble and servant oriented. That's a passion of mine that I have coming in, that I want us to be a people of servanthood. And what's interesting about this is if that indeed is who we are in the future, Jamie Dew will not be what brought that. What I've discovered is that these people are already that way. If I do anything for that, it will simply be in making that known and helping people to see that. And because this is a very humble, gracious people that want to just serve Christ and serve people. So I just think that the quality of that, spiritually speaking, is a fantastic place to be. Of course, I don't know which program you're looking at or anything, but I would certainly consider it. If I were starting over, I would come here and give it a really hard, honest look.
Well, Dr. Dew, that's really all we got. Know that we are praying for you. We are encouraged by you and praying for you as well as New Orleans Seminary.
Absolutely, man. I appreciate y'all's time today, okay?
All right, Eric. So, Dr. Jamie Dew.
Yeah, I was impressed. I was really impressed, yeah. You know, I don't know what it is. Every time I feel like I talk to a seminary president, I feel like I'm going to be listening to some ivory tower guy whose mind is lost on the greater things of God, you know, and it's just so good to hear someone that has such a love for people and a love for that seminary and a love for Baptists and a love in general just for people to come to know God better. And it just sounded like a guy that I would want to listen to.
Yeah, well, and I think, and he kind of talks about this a little bit through his interview. But he very much, just echo what you said, the same thing, right? He's not this ivory tower.
Yeah.
You look at somebody who has two PhDs and you're like, oh my goodness, this guy's going to be, but he never came off that way. But you know, he's also not that, he's well known, especially now.
Yeah.
But he wasn't before. So like that transition time for him, I'm sure has been, it's been crazy, but yeah. I was encouraged. I mean, I knew coming in that, he was going to be smart and
yeah,
and
I well. Heard good things about him.
Yeah. I also, and it's not about Dr. Aiken, but you could just hear through his commentary about Dr. Aiken of just how incredible
I mean, we were super impressed with him, too. So.
I mean, we were, and you can go listen to that episode. Goodness, it's been a while now. That was,
but I think he's right, though. I think it is a good time for Southern Baptists to be proud of the men that God has instituted at our institutions.
Yeah.
So
and when we say that we really like the schools and we really like, so because I'm in Southeastern, you were just talking about how you went to Southwestern, you're looking for doctoral work, which by the way, you're not looking to leave anytime soon.
No.
Let's just preface that. You're not looking to move to New Orleans like tomorrow.
Right.
So for those church members who are listening.
Yeah.
No, but when we say that we really like the seminaries, really like the schools, I think we really do mean that. You know, there's not one instance in me where I would tell somebody not to go
to seminary.
To seminary or to even the undergrad, the college in seminary. There's not one. If you feel like even an inch of call to ministry or you just want to learn more, it's incredibly valuable, regardless of where you go.
And I'm telling you, I do want to start my doctoral work, but I'm not going to let a seminary, a head of a seminary off the phone without asking him selfishly why I should go to his school.
Well, I did the same thing. When I went and visited Southeastern,
We got to meet Danny Aiken
in person, and that's
God,
why
he was so
thing.
Cool, man.
He was. He's a really good guy, and it's cool to hear from somebody else's mouth. How great, because it's always, you see these guys on stage, and, you know, they're they seem really cool, but then, like, you heard from JT English about Matt Chandler, and then now to hear from Dr. Dew about...
We're really killing it with these interviews.
I'm telling you what.
We're doing pretty good.
I'm telling you what. But we are thankful for Dr. Dew. We are praying for New Orleans Seminary, praying for them. We were over there last year.
Yes, last year.
For Mission Lab.
Man,
I'm surprised
like
you didn't bring
years
that
ago.
Up.
I'm surprised.
I was waiting on
well,
you.
Well, I didn't want him to ask me for coming back. You can only go to one camp.
It was good, yeah. We can only go. We are going to.
We are going to a Fuge camp, though,
we
like
are.
He said. So
he's a big fan. It shows they work.
They do work right. for everyone out there that
it
says
they
don't.
It shows
they
work.
Work.
Also, his testimony. That's pretty cool. I did
right?
not know much of that.
You know, I guess we just expect these
he grew
people
up
to come
in a church
these.
Family.
His mommy and daddy read the Bible with him every night before he went to sleep. You know, like we that's how we think.
Yeah.
And that's just not reality.
Yeah. Well, and those testimonies are really cool because it just shows that God can, and I don't mean to get old, but it shows how God can move through really anybody.
Yeah. And do whatever he wants to
for
do.
Everybody. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. All right. Well, thanks for listening all the way through again. We are thankful to FBC for allowing us to do this. And thankful for our listeners. We couldn't do what we do without them.
We are for the word, for the truth, and for the church. Thank you for listening to the Pastor and Intern Podcast.